Let's jog.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat, delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 513 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 17th, 2017. I am the Sala Monster, 1 week away from No Mercy, which means no pay-per-views this weekend. It's kind of nice when we have a little break from all the pay-per-views since there's so many of them. So we have one more week until that show this week. A lot of stuff to get to. My thoughts on the finals of the Mae Young Classic, which has now come and gone. Some thoughts on the Kevin Owens, Vince McMahon angle from SmackDown on Tuesday night, and a whole lot more. So this will be a good one. I want to thank everybody who has been taking advantage of our Audible offer, really all throughout the year, but especially over the last few weeks. You can still do so by going to audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Our good friends at Audible are offering listeners of this podcast a free trial for 1 month of the Audible service, and with that trial, whether you keep it or not, you get one free audiobook of your choice, and they've got a lot of books to choose from, including a lot of wrestling books. Daniel Bryan's book, Justin Roberts' book, Bob Holly, Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Shawn Michaels, Brock Lesnar. I could go on. There's a lot of books, but one that you may be interested in, just so you guys know, today is September 17th. This Tuesday, September 19th, there's a brand new Ric Flair book dropping, as written by Brian Shields. It's really about Rick and Charlotte. But if you want to get the new Ric Flair book for free, you can do so using our Audible link right now. Go ahead and sign up. Go to audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Make sure you activate your trial membership. And you can then, as of this Tuesday, you can pre-order it now, but as of this Tuesday, you can actually purchase for free. It's kind of an oxymoron, I guess, but you can get for free the new Ric Flair book that's not even out yet. It's not out for a couple more days as I am recording this, so get on that. The name of the book is Second Nature, The Legacy of Ric Flair and the Rise of Charlotte by Brian Shields, so definitely take advantage of that. Also, I haven't really been talking about it too much, but we do have a brand new 10-year anniversary t-shirt in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. So if you go to prowrestlingtees.com/Sala Monster Sounds Off, you'll see it's probably the first shirt listed there. I want to thank Steve for the awesome design. I love the design that he came up with. We are, of course, now less than 2 months away from commemorating the 10-year anniversary of this podcast. I haven't quite figured things out yet, but there will be a special show there, I think that first Sunday, probably in November. So that's rapidly coming up. You can get your anniversary shirt. And any shirt you get from our store, just so you guys are aware, if you tweet me a photo or Facebook me or what have you wearing the shirt, I will give you a retweet, since people like that kind of stuff. So I love seeing photos like that. By all means, if you do buy one, wear it. Send me the picture. I'd love to see it. Shout out to Nicholas, Nasty Nick, for buying a bunch of shirts from our store this week. Lastly here, before we move on, you can always make a PayPal donation if you would like to show your support of the show. TheSalaMonster.com is the place to go. You'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. Entirely up to you, but it's always there if you guys want to take advantage. $10 or more, as you know, will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. These are our VIPs here for this week. I actually want to give a big shout-out right off the bat to TV Tracks, which I feel I don't do enough. For his continued support of the show, I want to say thank you up front to him. Also, this man didn't make a donation this week, but he did one better. He made a Mama Monster sign, and he brought it with him to SmackDown in Las Vegas on Tuesday and got it on the hard camera. During at least during the Dolph Ziggler segment, that's when I noticed it. Of course, it was a Dolph Ziggler segment, so my mind was wandering, and I was looking around, and there it was. There was the Mama Monster shirt. So shout out to Donald Emery Nault III. Donald, thank you very much. You're awesome. As soon as I saw it, I screen capped it, and I sent it to her, and she thought it was so cool. That's an easy shout out right there, just so you know, if you want to, you know, get your sound off sign on TV. So there you go, Mama Monster, more over than Dolph Ziggler. Hey, you know, I think that could be a new t-shirt idea. That's actually not a bad one. Mama Monster, more over than Dolph Ziggler. See if somebody can come up with a design for that one. Thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, the Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, the Show Off Corey Van Dam, the Marietta Mahler Alexandru Mata, haven't heard from Alexandru in a while, hope he's doing okay, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, First Class LT Gilberry, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, the Wilmington Warlord Tyler Williams, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Houston Hangman George Perez. By the way, I hope Mama Eichard is doing well. The Houston Hangman George Perez, Airstrike Clinton Wright, Gift from God Garrett Mills, the Baton Rouge Bully Darius Moore, the Jive Soul Broski J. Ronald Jenkins, the Asian Sensation, Justin Lowe. And last but certainly not least here, Montese Antoine Moore, who has made a new theme song for Shane Strickland, a.k.a. Killshot from Lucha Underground, called Swerve, that I heard for the first time last night, and I have to say, it is badass. I even told him I love the little nod at the beginning to Shaka Khan, there at the start of the song. I didn't ask him if it was available anywhere yet, but I'm sure it will be soon. So definitely check that out when you have a chance to do so. Antoine's also going to be doing a special musical performance at the Primal Conflict Wrestling Show called Revolution Rumble next Saturday, September 23rd in Ranson, West Virginia. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat actually making a special appearance on that show. I think they got Shane Douglas on that show, Joey Matthews, a whole bunch of different people. So check out Montese there. Why don't we start with the Mae Young Classic, since I just want to talk about that first. The finals of the Mae Young Classic. Now, you guys know, Kairi Sane was my pick months ago to win it all, long before she was even announced for the tournament. This goes back to when I first was hearing, you know, the reports and the rumors that she was about to sign with WWE, or she had just signed with WWE. So again, long before any of the, you know, Mae Young Classic announcements were made and she was put in it, she was my pick to win the whole thing. And they did not disappoint me. I thought this was the perfect vehicle to get this girl over to a new audience. Really from her very first appearance. And you could argue, you know, in Full Sail, ooh, there's a lot of smart fans who know who she is from the Indies and Japan or whatever. And that's not totally wrong. But from the very first appearance she made on the network, she got a great reaction. People were behind her. She's just a great babyface. I don't really know how you can root against her. Of course, people will when she eventually comes to Raw, because I said the exact same thing about Bayley in NXT. And here's Bayley now, just a few months ago, getting booed out of the building on TV. So never underestimate WWE's ability to mess something up. But I thought the match itself between Kairi and Shayna Baszler was good. There were absolutely better matches in the tournament. By no means was it the best match of the Classic. I thought Kairi and Bianca Belair actually was better. I thought Kairi and Toni Storm was better. But I thought this was a good match. It wasn't really, it wasn't really the dramatic finale, I guess, that I was kind of hoping for. I also wasn't a fan of the format, I have to say. Having it sandwiched in between SmackDown and 205 Live like that, I didn't like that. They did a good job of trying to make it feel like a big deal with all the wrestlers at ringside and the red carpet stuff. The cast of GLOW was there. They did actually have Awesome Kong there. Bringing in Lillian Garcia to handle the ring announcing for the match was a nice touch, although I was surprised. Some of you said the same thing, and I agree. I was surprised for all the emphasis on women and the women's revolution and Lillian doing the ring announcing. They didn't have their one new female referee for the match. They had just a normal, male referee. I thought that was a little weird. I thought they'd want to put her out there. I think Jessica is her name. But it just didn't feel as big to me, I think, as they were trying to make it out to be. They tried, but I don't know. There was something a little off about it. And I think where and when, I think it comes down to the where and the when of when they held this thing. That had a lot to do with it. They also cut the six-person tag out that they had planned. I'm pretty sure they had made the announcement. I think I even said it on the show last week. There was going to be a six-person tag. I think Marty Bell was supposed to be in it, which was a little surprising to me. Although she was nowhere to be found here, but it was just the one match. There was no undercard. There was really nothing else. They had a couple of hype videos, and it was right to the finals. Boom, it was time for 205 Live. Got to get these women out of here and get 205 Live on the air because it's so important. That sound you heard, by the way, at 10:30 was the sound of remote controls all over the world turning off the WWE Network. Jim Ross and Lita had the call again, as they have for the rest of the tournament. Right off the bat, JR, this was amazing. The show starts. They're first on the air. And we see the announcers at ringside, and Jim Ross is introducing the show. And he asks Lita something to the effect of, like, what does this tournament mean to these women? Which somehow led to Lita talking about Shawn Michaels coming down from the ceiling on a zip line at WrestleMania 12. I don't know how we got there, but there it is. Once the match started, I thought the commentary was fine. There was one funny moment when they showed Asuka and Summer Rae. Yes, believe it or not, Summer Rae is still employed. They showed them and a few other, some of the other women at ringside, just for like maybe 5 or 10 seconds. Not even. And Jim Ross refers to them as the fans in the front row. Like the fans were on their feet. The fans in the front row. I laughed. I died. I'd like to think he knows who Asuka is, but it didn't come across that way. And in his defense, Summer Rae hasn't been on TV in like 20 years. So I can understand him not knowing who she is. But it reminded me of that photo. I know a lot of you guys remember this. Some of you may have never seen it. You can Google it and find it. It's still online. But there was a photo from many years ago. This is probably going back like a decade. When WWE, they did this tour of Japan. And WWE.com posted a photo of Jeff Hardy and Hiroshi Tanahashi together. I don't know if it was at the airport or whatever. But there they are. In the same photo together. And the caption that they put, the .com people put underneath this photo was something like, Jeff Hardy poses with a Japanese fan. It was like, and this was after Tanahashi had already been the champion a few times over there. It wasn't like he was some unknown rookie where it's like, okay, it could be an honest mistake. Like, no, they know who the guy was. But this was back during a time, like, it's kind of still like it now. But they're actually better now about making references to like people from other promotions and stuff. Certainly in NXT, they do a lot more of that now than they would have 10 years ago. Back then it was like taboo, like you couldn't even acknowledge there was a world outside of WWE. But yep, there it is, Tanahashi and Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy and the Japanese fan, posing for a photo with his fan. Ronda Rousey was there with the other horsewomen. Actually, I think one of them was missing. I think Roderick Strong's wife, what's her name? Marina. I don't think she was there. But Charlotte was there as well. Bayley, Becky Lynch. Again, Sasha Banks missing, just like she was the first time when they had the tapings for the Mae Young Classic. She was with the Raw crew headed over to New Zealand. And to my surprise, they did absolutely nothing to tease any sort of a match or a feud between the two groups. They obviously made the decision, look, we have half an hour. We're going to focus on this one match. We don't have time for anything else. Maybe part of it was they just didn't have all the women there. Like I said, I think there was one woman from each one of the groups missing. It could very well be that they didn't have all the troops together, and so let's hold off on shooting some kind of an angle, which I have no doubt they're going to do. I don't know if it's going to be for a match at Survivor Series. I don't know if it's going to be for something at WrestleMania. But, you know, Rousey and them are training. They're training for a reason. There's going to be a match. Maybe not a singles match with Ronda. Maybe it is an eight-person tag. You know, that would be my guess. In which case, it probably will happen before WrestleMania. Because I would think for WrestleMania, some of those women, Charlotte and whatnot, they're going to want singles matches. But it's coming. It's just a matter of when. But I was surprised they didn't even tease anything. Not even like a face-to-face or a shove or anything here on this show. I thought maybe after like, you know, Baszler lost, she would walk by Charlotte and her crew and start mouthing off at each other or something and lead to a shoving match, but nope, nothing. They promoted a red carpet appearance, by the way. I mentioned the red carpet. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't see the entire red carpet. I kind of skimmed it once I got home from work. But they promoted a red carpet appearance by Hope Solo. I didn't see Hope Solo there. They didn't show her in the crowd or anything like that. I'm guessing she wasn't there. I never saw her. My guess is she probably beat the shit out of her limo driver on the way to the show and just never made it there, if I know anything about Hope Solo. Match itself went just shy of 12 minutes. I actually used the stopwatch. First time I've busted out the Diva stopwatch in a while. Just shy of 12 minutes. That was disappointing. You know, again, this is the finals of the tournament. And to go 11 or 12 minutes, I think, is a little underwhelming. The story was basically Shayna Baszler working over Kyrie's arm, you know, take away the flying elbow as a weapon, which in the end failed. But that was the idea, I guess, behind the psychology of the match. Baszler did manage. She locked in the rear naked choke, or rear naked sleeper, I think, as JR called it. And who among us is not a naked sleeper? I mean, come on. But Kyrie fought out of it, the first person to do so in the entire tournament. And Kyrie also probably happens to be the smallest opponent that Baszler had. And yet she was the one who actually fought her way out of them. Well, actually, I guess Candice LeRae maybe would be. But anyway, she fought her way out, ended up on the top rope. Kyrie had sent Baszler backwards. Baszler's hanging on in like a tree of woe position. And Kyrie comes off with a double foot stomp. Comes off with the flying elbow drop of doom, gets the winning pinfall. Kyrie Saint wins the inaugural Mae Young Classic. They did make it a point to say inaugural, which would lead one to believe that there will be more of these, although I think they may have said the same thing about the Cruiserweight Classic, and I don't think we're getting another Cruiserweight Classic. I think, I don't know. I mean, after what they've done since, in the years since, I think that's a dead concept at this point. But they could absolutely do another women's tournament next year if they want to. I was going to say a tag team tournament, but that's what the Dusty Rhodes Classic kind of is, right? I mean, they could always expand the Dusty Classic to include teams from outside WWE. I think it would be kind of pointless to have a tag team tournament when you already have that, you know, so they could just sort of expand that if they want to. Triple H comes out, hits her with the flower power finish. Stephanie and Sara Del Rey join them in the ring. I would have popped huge if Vince McMahon, after the angle they had just did with Kevin Owens, came marching down to the ring with his head all wrapped up in like bloody bandages to celebrate with them. But sadly, that did not happen. Crowd came alive for the last few minutes. You know, one of my concerns, if you remember going into this, was I wish this was a Full Sail. As it turned out, by the way, Full Sail was closed because of the hurricane. It didn't reopen until the next day, so it would have been a moot point anyway. But I was worried about that crowd coming off of SmackDown and how dead they sometimes are for 205 Live. Now you have two women out there. They don't even know who they are. How are they going to be? They weren't up for the whole thing, but I think towards the end they came alive, which was nice to see. I thought after 2 hours of SmackDown in front of literally a half-empty building that these ladies would have been doomed, but the crowd hung in there. Now, according to The Observer, interesting little note here, the original plan was to actually do Kairi Sane against Toni Storm in the finals, but they changed their minds for whatever reason. They went with Shayna Baszler instead. Toni Storm is not signed, by the way. And you could have had her in the finals even if she's not signed. I mean, she wasn't going to win, so it didn't matter. But she's not signed. I think I incorrectly said last week that she was. If so, I apologize. She is not signed with them yet. I believe she is still under contract with the Stardom promotion over in Japan. Somebody actually sent me a message saying she's still under contract for another year to Stardom. I don't know about that, about the length. I don't know how easy it would be for her to get out of that contract. Point is that she's not coming in just yet. Hopefully, once she's free of those obligations, WWE would be nuts not to snatch this woman up because she's too good not to be a big star on TV over here. She's only 21, so it's not as though the clock is ticking. You better do something now. You got time. You know, look, she can come in 2 or 3 years. It's not like this urgent thing. It's certainly not a case of them lacking in female talent. So maybe she wants to wrestle all over the world for the next 5 years and then come in. That's ultimately her decision. But I think at some point, she has to end up in WWE. I mean, she's just too good not to be there. Triple H announced that, and he did so on ESPN. Who would have thought, right, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that ESPN would be the place where Triple H would be breaking announcements about women's matches in WWE. This, if you think back to the women's matches we used to get on TV. But there he was on ESPN making the announcement that Kairi Sane, by virtue of her win here, will get a shot at the vacant NXT Women's Championship in Houston at the next TakeOver show in November. Now, as per the tapings, they did a new set of NXT tapings on Thursday at Full Sail. I don't read all the results from that because I don't want to know all the results. But one thing that came out of it is that the match to determine a new champion at TakeOver, which will include Kairi Sane, will be a fatal four-way. So that answers that question about what they're going to do. Are they going to do a tournament? Are they going to do a battle royal? They're going to have a fatal four-way. Now, how they're going to determine the women in the battle in the four-way, I don't know. I won't say who else beyond Kairi is involved. You can search around and find out if you want to. Because they have announced, I think, all but one of the people who will be in that match. I actually would not put the title on Kairi Sane. I think it's too soon. I would not put the championship on her in November. I would hold off until the TakeOver show in New Orleans over WrestleMania weekend. That's when I would do it. And it's even better that it's a four-way in Houston. So she can lose that match without actually being beaten. If that's a concern, like, oh, should we beat her this early in her run? She doesn't have to be pinned. You know, you can pin any of the other women in the match and basically protect her and set her up for the eventual title win in April. So that's what I would do. Let's talk about Raw from Monday night. Raw was live from Anaheim, California. We had over 1,800 votes on our Raw poll this week on Twitter. 68% thumbs up, 32% thumbs down. So another positive overall rating for Raw. I don't know how many weeks in a row that makes this. It's at least a month. So what happened on this show? Jason Jordan had another good showing with a top guy to open the show. This time they fed him to the big dog. I actually like this match more than I did his match with John Cena. He did the double Northern Lights suplex spot again, which is always cool. Roman pinned him with a spear. He wasn't taking Jason Jordan seriously when this thing started, but when the match was over, he shook his hand, he showed respect. That's how you put somebody new over. So now Jason Jordan has lost to John Cena. He has lost to Roman Reigns. Okay, two of the biggest stars in the company, if not the two biggest stars. He looked good in both matches, but he lost. Now he's got to go out and start winning. He can't keep losing matches. Unless the idea is to just have him lose and lose and lose and lose and lose and just snap and attack his father, he's got to start winning matches. He lost these two, which is fine, but he's got to win some now. So John Cena came out after the match to confront Roman Reigns, and as Reigns did to him basically the week before. This was easily the worst of the three little work shoots that they've done so far, largely because I thought this was way too forced. This was way too forced. There were things said the first two times I could actually believe, like real genuine burns. I guess there was a burn here at the end by Cena, but this was just saying stuff that had just no basis in reality. It was just being said to get a reaction, mostly coming from Roman Reigns. Poor guy, what they scripted him to say, he looked like an idiot. Roman said that I've had more great matches in 2 years than John Cena's had his entire career. He called Cena a bitch ass. Boy, he sure does using that word bitch, doesn't he? He said the reason John Cena came to Raw and called him out is because he knows that he, being Roman, is selling more tickets than John Cena has sold in 5 years. Reigns said ticket sales are great. Revenue is sky high. WWE doesn't need you. He said this in a week where WWE barely got 7,000 people in the building for Raw in Anaheim, which has a capacity of at least double that. I think it's more than double, but a capacity of at least double that. Even with the usual WWE setup and blocking off part of the arena by the Titantron, 7,000 is not a good number. They had to tarp off different sections of the arena. SmackDown was even worse. If you look at the photos, apparently the number was barely 4,000 people in the building in Vegas for SmackDown on Tuesday, and that was for a show that promoted the return of Vince McMahon. A week in advance, they let people know that Mr. McMahon is going to be here. Mr. McMahon hasn't been on SmackDown in years. Plus, they're taping the Mae Young Classic Finals, all of these different things. 4,000 people in the building. And it showed. I mean, you look at those pictures from the middle of the show. I mean, these are not pictures that people snap an hour before, and it's like, dude, it's an hour before the show. You know, like, what's your agenda here? There were photos from the middle of the show as SmackDown was in progress, and, you know, they always keep sections open behind the hard camera. That's just standard practice. This goes far beyond keeping some seats empty behind the hard camera. This is sad. And this is not the first time with SmackDown in recent weeks that this has happened. This has become the norm. I mean, this has become a pattern here. But 4,000 people in the building for SmackDown at the Thomas and Mack Center, that's not good. Of all the weeks for them to script this guy to talk about how great ticket sales are when they have half-empty buildings for their TV, that's really embarrassing. He said John Cena can't break into Hollywood. That was another one of his wonderful lines that nobody could buy into. John Cena can't break into Hollywood. The same John Cena who just landed a leading role in his own Transformers spinoff. The same Transformers franchise that's made something like $4 billion worldwide. John Cena can't break into Hollywood. But the money line came at the end from John Cena. John Cena literally did a mic drop at the end after telling Roman that at No Mercy, consider me like a drug test. You ain't getting past me. Cena got the last word with that one because there's no response. What was Roman going to say? He stood there and he smirked because he knows I got nothing. I got no comeback to that. Easily the weakest, I thought, of the three face-offs they've had. So it's like the law of diminishing returns. Every week they do one of these, it gets a little worse and a little worse and a little less realistic and a little less realistic until now they're just spouting bullshit. The stuff about the tickets, though, I couldn't believe. Playing to a half-empty house that night, they had him go out there and say that. Amazing. I thought the Brock Lesnar-Braun Strowman confrontation, again, did a very good job of making Strowman out to be Brock's, you know, toughest challenge to date. In fact, Heyman was out there talking about Brock being the underdog going into their title match in No Mercy. When Strowman came out and Brock took him down with the German suplex, Strowman no-sold it. He popped right back up. Clearly, Braun Strowman has been making use of his WWE Network subscription and studying Hulk Hogan matches. Strowman then gave him a choke slam. He gave him the big power slam finish. He grabbed the Universal title. He put his foot on Brock's chest. If you count SummerSlam, this is basically the third straight time that Braun Strowman has left Brock Lesnar laying. And I'm not even sure Lesnar is going to be in the building for the go-home show tomorrow night. There may be a video or something, but I don't think he is scheduled to actually be there. I don't see how Braun Strowman wins this match or wins the championship next Sunday. I mean, it's almost a case where he's been too dominant going into the pay-per-view for me to believe that he might actually win. I can't see him going in there and demolishing Brock and just winning the title. After three straight weeks of killing Brock, he's going to go into the pay-per-view, kill him again, and win the belt. I don't see it. But they've done as good of a job of building a new star with Braun Strowman as they have done anybody else all year. In fact, I think they've done such a good job with Strowman that, you know, he may be the biggest star practically from scratch. I mean, it's not as though he comes from the Indies. He didn't come from New Japan. He didn't come from Ring of Honor. You know, for as little experience as this guy has, coming in and doing what he's been able to do is pretty incredible. And to me, Braun Strowman is hands down, you know, everybody has their awards that they give out at the end of the year. Braun Strowman is hands down the breakout star of the year. If you would have said to me, if you would have said to a lot of other people a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when he first came in, he was part of the Wyatt family, sort of as a background player, you know, the big giant to stick in the background. If you would have said to me that this guy would be as capable as he is at this point for somebody who had practically no experience, I think even he says, before they brought him up to the main roster and put him on TV, he had maybe had 8 matches before that in his life. Completely leapfrogged NXT. They send guys to NXT that have 15 years experience working around the world. He didn't even wrestle in NXT. 8 matches in his entire life, they put him on the main roster, and look at him now. That's pretty incredible. Speaking of Strowman, they gave away the first Braun Strowman-John Cena match here on this show. This was not quite the beating that Cena took in the match with Brock at SummerSlam a few years ago, but it was close. It was close. This was as one-sided an ass-kicking, I think, as John Cena has had in a match since the match with Lesnar at SummerSlam. Cena finally hit an AA. Strowman rolled out to the floor. When Cena came out after him, Strowman hit him with the ring steps, which, for some reason, was not a DQ. But then when Strowman threw the steps into the ring and gave John Cena a power slam on them, the referee did call for the DQ. So I guess anything goes if you're outside the ring. Which reminds me, and I'll never not use this as an opportunity to bring up the Ultimate Warrior Rick Rude match from SummerSlam 89. I mentioned it, I probably mentioned this like once every year or so it comes up. It was the match where Warrior hit Rude with the Intercontinental belt. They were outside the ring. Jesse Ventura is on commentary with Tony Schiavone, and he loses his mind about how that should be a disqualification. Where's the referee? And Schiavone just calmly explains, well, you see, Jesse, it happened outside the ring. And Jesse just says, like, so you're going to tell me that you can shoot somebody outside the ring, and so long as it's outside, it's okay? He's like, you're even dumber than Monsoon. And I thought he was the stupidest man alive. Jesse would not be pleased with the officiating here in this match. Although, he probably would hate John Cena. So, he actually might be willing to let this slide. Actually, now that I think about it, he turned heel on John Cena, didn't he? Yes, he did. Yes, he did. John Cena, man, how many years ago was this? Jesus. Probably 10 years ago. Oh my God, it's almost been a decade. There was an episode, maybe 8 years ago, there was an episode of Raw where Jesse was the guest host when they were in their guest host mode. It was the same night Jesse did commentary with Vince on that Battle Royal. But I remember now, at the end of that show, there was a segment, maybe like a contract signing or something with John Cena and Sheamus. This was right after Sheamus had come in, he was going to get a title shot. And Jesse Ventura turned on John Cena. So there you go. Jesse would love it. Cena's getting screwed over. I think Jesse would be okay with it. It is now official that Asuka is on her way to Monday Night Raw. Say a prayer for her. They aired a video for her and said that Kurt Angle had signed the hottest free agent in WWE. I think that might be news to John Cena. Miz and Maryse are expecting their first child, baby Miz, next year. Congrats to the happy couple. I am sad that this means in the next few months we will not have Maryse on TV anymore. But just think, like, in a few years, baby Miz will be on TV cutting shoot promos on Birdie Danielson. It's something to look forward to. Miz was going to read a poem prepared for his mommy-to-be when all of a sudden Enzo Amore interrupts. And Miz then proceeds to bury Enzo. Talks about how he doesn't know when to shut his mouth. That's why you get kicked off WWE tour buses. Which probably, you know, 10 people in the crowd knew what he was talking about. But that's the new thing lately. We shoot for the insiders. He said the only reason he ended up in the cruiserweight division, it's not because the cruiserweight division is the place to be. It's not because Enzo is so successful that he wants to go for the cruiserweight championship. It's this great goal of his. No. Miz says, and this was a total shoot, the only reason that you ended up in the cruiserweight division is because you had nowhere else to go. Because nobody on the Raw roster likes you. He compared himself to Enzo, says that that used to be me. You used to be me. Or I used to be you, or whatever. But I earned the respect of my peers. And I see a lot of promise in you, but you make mistake after mistake after mistake. Like dropping 10 grand on tickets to go see Mayweather and McGregor. Miz didn't actually say that, but I'm saying it. He said all Enzo cares about is hanging out with third-rate rappers. Which I guess is nice to hear that K-Fed is once again hanging around the WWE crew. Miz ended by calling Enzo a con artist with a couple of catchphrases, which I thought was, you know, as we talk about Cena and Reigns and Cena burning Reigns with some of these lines, that hit very close to home, this line here, because, you know, I mean, con artist is a little harsh, but that's really what Enzo is. Without the catchphrases, take away the catchphrases and all the t-shirts with the catchphrases on them, and what do you really have left with Enzo? You really don't have much of anything left with Enzo. So I thought that was quite the line there to include there in that promo. absolutely nothing Miz said here was untrue, which is why the crowd cheered for a lot of what he was saying. They booed Enzo, or at least enough people booed him for it to be noticeable on TV. Enzo's great comeback was saying that Miz copied Chris Jericho and Ric Flair. He copies other people, and he called him a paper champion. Seriously, that's the best they could come up with for this guy to say in response to everything Miz had just said to him. So that tells you right there who won this war of words. Then they had a match, which Enzo won by DQ when all three of the Miztourage guys mugged him in the ring. Miz laid him out with a skull-crushing finale and left him laying. This did absolutely nothing to get me interested in seeing Enzo Amore challenge Neville for the Cruiserweight Championship in No Mercy. And I don't know how, if you are a fan of 205 Live and you are a fan of the Cruiserweights and all that, I don't really see how this segment did anything to get you excited either. But if the idea was to get people to cheer the Miz like a babyface, then hey, mission accomplished. My magic 8-ball says that, in fact, that was not what they had intended, but that was the outcome of what they did here. They ended the show with Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and the Hardys beating Anderson, Gallows, Cesaro, and Sheamus. It was a weird match to end with. I'm not really sure why they didn't just end with John Cena and Braun Strowman, as big of a match as that was, unless they just did not want to end the show on a down note with Cena being destroyed the way he was. I mean, you know, it's like... It's not an Asian massage parlor. You don't need a happy ending all the time. Cena Strowman was a big match. They should have ended with that. Either that or the Brock segment. Brock's the champion. Maybe he should be out there in the main event. Have Strowman come back out and lay him out then. Let's talk about SmackDown. Sin City SmackDown from Las Vegas on Tuesday night. Twitter poll. Also, remarkably consistent you guys are, over 1,800 votes, 85% thumbs up, 15% thumbs down. So you guys thought SmackDown apparently was amazing this week. I wouldn't go that far. Although there was a pretty amazing closing angle here on this show, which we'll get to. But just some of the key things. AJ Styles beat Ty Dillinger to retain the U.S. title with the Calf Crusher. I like that AJ is starting to win more matches with the Calf Crusher. I think it'll make it more dramatic when he finally uses it in like a big match and people actually buy into it as a finish. The only way that people are going to buy into it is if he actually starts winning some matches with it. So I like that. This was longer than their first match. Their first match barely went 60 seconds. This one went a little bit longer. Not too much longer, but about 5 minutes, I think this thing went, before Baron Corbin ran down. He didn't really factor too much into the finish. Dillinger got a near fall off the distraction, but after the match was over, Corbin laid both guys out. He told AJ that next week, I am accepting your open challenge. And so it is official. On SmackDown this Tuesday, it will be AJ Styles and Baron Corbin for the U.S. title. By the way, AJ wore a pretty badass mask to the ring as part of the SmackDown tour of Japan this weekend. There's a bunch of photos of him in the mask floating around on social media. It's got knives through it as part of the design. Really cool stuff. I do know he wore a mask in New Japan as well. This is different. This is not the same mask. I've seen pictures of them side by side. But I definitely think he should use it again, maybe for WrestleMania. Which leads me to Mrs. Roboto. Dasha Fuentes. WWE's resident android announcer. What the hell was this? What was this? The words Dasha Robot were apparently trending on Twitter at one point, which I think speaks volumes. If you saw the segment, you know why. So they cut to her backstage. Corbin is walking to the back. They cut to her, and there she is, looking like a deer in headlights, as most of these backstage interviewers do, but her more so than most. There she is, standing there, looking off into the distance. And, you know, we've all joked that these backstage interviewers talk like robots. It's a running joke at this point. Some people can pull off horrible dialogue, right? Renee Young is very good at showing at least some personality when she is forced into similar situations. She was great on Talking Smack. So we know how personable and sort of charismatic Renee can be. And then they canceled it. If you remember when they canceled Talking Smack, remember what she said on Twitter. She was all upset. She was very disappointed. And she said, well, guess I'll go back to welcoming my guest at this time. the snark was strong with Renee Young when she found out that Talking Smack was being taken off the air. Even she knows how ridiculous they sound out there. So I have sympathy for all of these backstage people, even Dasha here. Although Dasha probably as an android can't feel emotion. But I feel bad for these people. Because they know it's bullshit. They know it's ridiculous. But they're told to do something, and when your boss tells you to do something, you do it. The better question is, why does their boss insist on this? Because it doesn't make for good TV. This was the worst I've ever seen it. This was the worst that I've ever seen it. I don't even know what this was. It looked like someone forgot to charge her batteries before they put her on TV. Now Dasha actually had personality when she was down at NXT. So I know she's got it in her. I can see why they hired her. You know, she's a pretty girl, but like in NXT, they would have her like rev up like before the shows and everything. And she actually had personality and she was outgoing and charming and all that. So I remember her from the NXT days. I know she has it in her. So does Mike Rome. He's another one. Go back and listen to Mike Rome. He did the ring announcing on Monday night. Go back and listen to Mike Rome on Raw and compare it to his ring announcing in NXT. Someone who used to work for WWE DM'd me after the Dasha segment, because they saw the Dasha segment. They were mortified by it. Absolutely mortified. Not necessarily shocked, but they were mortified by it. And again, she only had a couple of lines. You know, they threw it to her, and her job was to say Sin City SmackDown is... Here, I'll do it the way that she should have done it. You know, they throw it to her, and she says, Sin City SmackDown is definitely living up to its name. Now, please welcome my guest, Rusev. Okay, even that's shitty, okay, because this dialogue is shit. But I'm trying to make the, you know, chicken salad out of chicken shit here. They threw it to her, and this is a reenactment that, honestly, I don't think is too far off. She is holding the microphone and goes, Sin City SmackDown is definitely living up to its name. Now please welcome my guest, Rusev. And she slowly turns her head. It was creepy. I'm not going to lie. It was fucking creepy when she said Rusev's name the way she said and how she turned. And then Rusev comes into camera view. And Rusev looks like a male android. He's looking off into the distance. They do this with all the interviews. They look off into the distance. I don't think he made eye contact with her once. Now, maybe he's afraid of her because, again, you never stare directly into the eyes of an android. So maybe he knew that. But at no point during this interview did he even make eye contact with her. Why do they do this? They have to realize that this just is bad TV. Oh, my God. But seriously, if you can go find the Dasha thing, it's like 10 seconds. It's awful. It's absolutely off. But it highlights a larger problem in this company and the way that they do this. I mean, you know, people talk about how when they show them watching on monitors in the back, how ridiculous that looks. I know, you know, we're picking nits here when it comes to this stuff, that this company has bigger problems than this. But clearly I wasn't the only one who saw this and went, wait a minute, is there something wrong with her? Is she on something? It was terrible. I am actually looking forward to SmackDown this week to see her again backstage to see if she's any worse. I don't think she could be any worse. I feel like, you know, this was hopefully just a one-time thing. But this was awful. This was absolutely awful. Then we had Jinder Mahal and the Singh brothers. Speaking of awful. Out for a promo on Shinsuke Nakamura. If this segment was an animal, it would have rabies and be shot dead. This was one of those WWE comedy segments that's supposed to be funny, but ends up being funny only to the people who write this shit. Jinder had them put a picture of Nakamura up on the Titantron, one of those weird faces that Nakamura makes. They mocked the photo. Jinder joked about Nakamura looking constipated, and the Singh brothers then would roll on the floor fake laughing. That's going to be me on Tuesday afternoons. When the Raw ratings begin to come in with Monday Night Football back on the air, they kind of held their own this past week. Give it a few weeks. We'll all be the ones rolling around in laughter on the floor. They showed Nakamura another photo of him up on the screen, and Jinder said that that's the face that Nakamura makes when he sees Godzilla. Ooh, that's funny. That's funny. That's creative. That really is. The point of all this was for him to point out to Nakamura that, see, these fans are a bunch of racists. They are a bunch of racist American fools who will laugh at you and turn on you in the blink of an eye. You don't want to be WWE champion. Trust me. That was the gist of this, okay? Now, he did have one line about Nakamura looking like Pikachu having a seizure that got some laughs, but this segment sucked. This segment just died a death. And this is the WWE champion in the middle of the show in a horrible comedy segment. So, what that says about the state of the WWE title is not very good. The New Day against the Usos. They had a Sin City street fight. This made up for this and the end of the show made up for everything else on the show. If there was anything bad on this show, and there was some bad stuff, this more than made up for it. This was for the tag team titles. This was the highlight of the show. For me, it was the highlight of the. I guess you could say Owens killing Vince McMahon was, but this match was awesome. I could watch these guys wrestle all day long. The Usos went up for the double Samoan splash. Kofi shoved Jey Uso off the top. He went crashing through a table that had been set up outside the ring earlier. Kofi hit Jimmy with the Trouble in Paradise. New Day hit the Midnight Hour. They are once again SmackDown Tag Team Champions. I think now they are four-time Tag Team Champions. Kofi had some sick hang time on the jump on that Midnight Hour. I know they're playing hot potato with the tag team title. Some people don't like that, but you know what? I don't even care. If they keep giving us matches like this, like fun matches like this, you know what? They could switch the title five more times. Who cares? This was great. And then we had Dolph Ziggler. Remember what I said a moment ago about how this match made up for all the bad stuff on this show? And, well, this was part of the bad stuff. Dolph Ziggler continues to have himself an identity crisis. First, he came out dressed like Bayley, doing her full entrance with the wacky waving inflatable arm flailing tube men. Then he came and he left and came back out again, and he came out with an Ultimate Warrior mask on, doing the crazy warrior sprint down to the ring to his theme music. Dana Warrior was ringside for this, since they brought her in for the Mae Young Classic finals. So she was there. You know, it's weird, like, there were people who actually were upset about this. Like, it was, they thought it was somehow disrespectful. You're always going to have people online who are offended by every little thing. There were some people, apparently, who were offended by this, and they thought it was in poor taste. Let me tell you something. The only reason I'm sure that they even did this, they knew that Dana Warrior was going to be there, so they went out of their way to have this guy impersonate her husband and play the music and everything else as their little way of showing tribute to him, right? And Dana was there saying, boo, she was like the stunt granny on that NBC special all those years ago when they show you the tricks of the pro wrestling business. She was out there playing her role, you know, booing Dolph. It's like, clearly she wasn't offended by any of this. I'm not really sure why somebody else would be, but again, people sometimes, they look for things to be offended by. There was nothing wrong with this, please. I mean, really? But anyway, this Dolph stuff, okay? This is like the third week now that we've been subjected to this. This has to be leading to a feud with Bobby Roode. It's the only explanation I have for this. I assume that's the reason they've kept Roode off the show now for two straight weeks. That better be the reason, because if they've kept him off for anything else, they're out of their minds. So the fact that he's been MIA from SmackDown for 2 weeks, I'm okay with it if the idea, let's say this week, is to have Dolph come out again and bore us, and then out comes Bobby Roode to save us. Like, that's fine. And I assume that's where this is going. The highlight of this entire segment, by the way, was had nothing to do with Dolph. It was actually the Mama Monster sign in the crowd that made TV. But you guys already knew that. But, you know, this whole Ziggler thing, you know what they should do? I was thinking about this. Because I have not enjoyed what they've been doing with Dolph. He just takes up time on TV. He's, at this point, he's completely useless on this roster. But I guess he's not. Because if they are going to do something with him and Roode, they did the same thing with him and Nakamura. I think Ziggler's role basically now is the guy who has maybe a tiny shred of credibility because he kind of used to be a star, and so let's use him to get the new guys over. So that doesn't make him useless, but you know, any hope for him, if you think this is a push, it's going to lead to something, that ship sailed years ago, okay? That's just not going to happen. That's his role now. His role is to come out and be made a fool, but to put the new guys over, to try to give them some credibility. That's it. That's his role. He worked with Corbin, and that was basically his role. He worked with Nakamura, and that was his role. And now I think he'll work with Roode. And that will be his role. But that doesn't mean that this has to be, you know, not entertaining or not interesting. I think you can at least try to have some fun with this. So I was thinking about it. I'm like, why not just go all the way with Dolph acting all nutty and, again, having this identity crisis and all that? I think that he and Bobby Roode, when they have their first, and you, I guess you could do it maybe in the rematch and not the first match, but why drag this out, right? I assume their first match is going to be a singles match at Hell in a Cell. I think that when they have their match, it should be a straitjacket match. You do a straitjacket match at Hell in a Cell, with the loser being committed to a mental institution and taken away in a straitjacket. So they don't wrestle in them, but the loser is basically put in a straitjacket. And they ought to film this the way that they filmed the end of the Mountie Big Boss Man match at SummerSlam 91. When they had that jailhouse match at Madison Square Garden. Just have a bunch of dudes in white coats come out and drag Ziggler away in the straitjacket, kicking and screaming. Have a camera follow them, a single camera shot, follow them through the halls backstage, all the way to a waiting van in the parking garage. All the wrestlers kind of popping their heads out of the locker rooms as Dolph is being dragged along and screaming. And they throw him in the van. Have a camera at the mental hospital to show them arriving later in the show. Then come back again later and show him being checked in, trying to escape. And then they finally throw him into a padded cell. I mean, at this point, just go all the way with it. I think, you know, at least make it entertaining. Speaking of dressing up as other people, I noticed on the calendar here that SmackDown falls on Halloween Day this year. So here's hoping they promote a special Halloween Havoc episode of SmackDown. And they make it a big show. Look, you know, I guess you could, actually what you could do is you could do the first Roode Ziggler match at Hell in a Cell, and then maybe on the Halloween episode of SmackDown at the end of the month, because I don't think there's another SmackDown pay-per-view until probably December, I would think. They could really build that Halloween show up in advance with like two or three big matches, and maybe they do the Ziggler-Roode rematch there and do the straitjacket match on that show. That actually might be funnier. You know, if that episode of SmackDown is basically one big costume party, I think the visual, probably, of these guys in white lab coats dragging Dolph Ziggler in a straitjacket, kicking and screaming from the ring as though he's the crazy one, but, like, as he's being dragged through the hallway, we see, like, in the background, like, some of the wrestlers dressed up in these weird-ass Halloween costumes, and it kind of makes you think, like, why is he the one being dragged to the van to be taken to the mental hospital, right? You see, like, Big E and, like, New Day dressed as God knows what in the background. I think that could be a lot of fun. They did a heavy angle to close out the show with Kevin Owens and Vince McMahon making his first appearance on SmackDown in many years. There's something about Las Vegas that brings out the worst in Kevin Owens. First, we had the Festival of Friendship and what he did to poor Chris Jericho. Now this. It's like that angle, this showed us more of a violent side of Kevin Owens that, you know, we first got to see when he came to NXT, and I think he kind of got away from that for a while on the main roster, doing all the stuff with Jericho, but there is a sadistic side to Kevin Owens that came out here, and I think it works for him. I think that's the difference between main event level Kevin Owens and, like, mid-card Kevin Owens, is when he gets serious and he does stuff like this. You know, he's a top guy. You know, maybe not the top guy on the brand, but he's somebody that you have to take seriously. Put it this way, I take him more seriously at this point than I take the champion. So what does that tell you? Champion's out there making jokes about Godzilla and constipation. You know what I mean? Like, some guys can pull that off, I guess. The Rock can pull that off. John Cena, well, John Cena barely could, but yeah, that's not gender's forte. So Vince McMahon is out there, they're in the ring, and Vince promises to fire Kevin Owens the minute he files his lawsuit against the company, which Owens has promised to do. Vince said that the B by my name stands for billionaire, the B by your name would soon stand for bankrupt. For a moment there, it seemed like Vince thought he was cutting a promo on CM Punk. He said that he suspended Shane, or I'm sorry, he suspended my son Shane, not because he put your hands on Kevin Owens, or he put his hands on Kevin Owens, but because he didn't finish the job. And Owens, I tell you what, after that line, Owens really does have himself one hell of a lawsuit after that. That was dumb. And he got it on camera, no less, on live TV. Vince then reinstated Shane, so it was a short-lived suspension, and he made a match between Kevin Owens and Shane McMahon inside Hell in a Cell. In fact, I'm wondering if that's going to be the sole Hell in a Cell match on that entire pay-per-view. I think it might be. Now, Shane already lost one Hell in a Cell match last year. That was against The Undertaker, which makes me think that they wouldn't have him lose a second one, which would mean that Kevin Owens is losing this match. And, you know, I guess Shane is popular enough that it really wouldn't totally kill Owens if he did lose to him. But still, I'm not really sure how I feel about the idea that, you know, Shane McMahon may well beat Kevin Owens here in this Hell in a Cell match. Owens said, fine, but I want you to promise me that I won't be fired if I beat a McMahon senseless, if I beat your son senseless. And Vince put his hand out and Owens shook it, and then he Shabbat'd himself and gave Vince a headbutt. Well, I guess technically he Shabbat'd Vince, since Vince was the one who ended up bleeding from the head. I like the angle, okay? There's a lot of people talking about this angle this week. Most people loved it. Some people didn't like it because of, you know, Vince is old. And look, I liked the angle. I thought it was a big deal and a great sort of cliffhanger ending to the show. What's going to be the fallout from this? And it's a great position for Kevin Owens to be in. I respect the hell out of Vince McMahon, especially at 72 years old, to still be taking bumps like this. But I think we can stop with the shoot headbutts, right? I think we can do away with that. I think the last thing Grandpa needs to be doing is headbanging with Kevin Owens. And you know it was totally his idea, too, right? I mean, that just reeks of a Vince McMahon idea. Hey, you know, it'd be cool if you headbutt me right in the head. And make sure you do it really hard, too. Now, I will say, it was nice to see blood for a change, because I think it can be very effective when you do use it and you don't overuse it, so that was nice. Blood did begin to trickle down Vince's face. A lot of talk that Vince may have bladed himself backstage before he came out, and they used makeup to cover the wound so that when Owens gave him the headbutt, it would open right up. I can believe that. I don't know. I've seen close-ups of Vince's face where it looks maybe a little discolored, like maybe they put makeup right in the middle of his forehead. Who knows? They probably gimmicked it somehow to make sure that he would definitely bleed, because they zoomed in as soon as that blood began to show up. It's not like the camera shied away or they went black and white. They zoomed in on that thing, which normally they would not do. You know, even when the referees, like, slid into the ring, like, no gloves and all the usual. Like, when Vince McMahon is in the ring, when Vince is part of something, all the usual protocol goes right out the window, because this guy's just going to do whatever he wants. But, yeah, if that was not expected, then I don't believe they would have been zooming in on it as quickly as and as eagerly as they did. So kudos to them, you know, it worked, but I still think it's dumb for, you know, a guy like Vince to be taking a headbutt like that to the head. Vince fought his way back up to his feet. He went to throw a punch at Owens. Owens blocked it, punched him instead. Then he kicked him in the ribs. He gave Vince a super kick. He gave Vince a frog splash off the top rope. He did everything but give this guy a pop-up powerbomb, which I was waiting for, and that never came. But like with Randy Orton, all those years ago when Orton punted Vince in the head, after the damage had already been done, the reality began to set in for Kevin Owens, and he had this look on his face like, oh shit, what have I done? Stephanie McMahon, who was there for the Mae Young Classic, walked out. I thought for sure Owens was getting slapped, but instead she told Owens to get to the back. I guess that makes sense, because the whole reason this even started was that Shane, one of Vince's kids, put his hands on the talent, and Owens threatened to sue the entire family and sue the company. So I guess it wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense to have Vince's other kid come out and put her hands on Kevin Owens. So she restrained herself, and she just yelled at Owens to just go to the back. Seeing Stephanie there, I will say, and we've seen her with the Mae Young Classic stuff as well, but seeing her here on this show, I realized that one of the reasons I know, one of the reasons that Raw has been a little more tolerable these last few months is the fact that we've had no Stephanie McMahon on Monday nights. Hopefully it stays that way. You know she's going to be back at some point. She technically still is the commissioner of that show, and she's got Kurt Angle in charge running things. You know at some point that's going to go south. I think we all expect it. Hopefully it's still many months away from happening. But this was a great way to showcase Kevin Owens, and it's a great spot for him to be in working against the McMahons. I mean, it's been 20 years of this stuff with the McMahons. We've seen every possible iteration of Vince or Shane or Stephanie feuding with people and getting slapped, and Vince Shane taking a crazy bump, and Vince saying, "You're fired." And I mean, yes, we've seen this so many times in the last 20 years. We already know the script. But the fact is, you know, Kevin Owens at this moment is in a higher profile program on this show than the WWE champion is right now. And to me, that speaks more about how much that title has fallen, I think, than anything else.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT, they had the tapings at Full Sail on Thursday night. I did not read them all, but as far as the spoilers go, but a certain former Ring of Honor star did make his debut with the tapings. If you absolutely do not want to know who or what happened, skip ahead 30 seconds. It was Lio Rush, who was later beaten in his very first match by the Velveteen Dream, who is his former tag team partner on the indie scene. So no different than Kyle O'Reilly or Bobby Fish when they had their first matches on NXT and they lost to Aleister Black. It's just sort of what they do. Speaking of Fish and O'Reilly, they, along with Adam Cole, finally have a name for their group. The Undisputed Era. If ever there was a time for Vince McMahon to get his hands on a name and shorten it, this is it. See, I think Undisputed, or even The Undisputed, that actually sounds pretty cool. Where this era thing comes from, I have no idea. I thought maybe it wasn't the actual name. It was just a reference, like now we're living in the era of the Undisputed and their name was Undisputed. But no, if you go to the page on WWE Shop, it says the Undisputed Era Merchant. I mean, that's the name. I mean, the Undisputed Era, like when I say that out loud, it sounds like somebody describing WWE in 2002. It sounds like somebody going through all the different periods of WWE over the years, the Golden Era, the Attitude Era, the New Generation Era, the PG Era, and like around the Ruthless Aggression period, coming up with the Undisputed Era. That's what I think of when I hear that. But their first shirt went up on WWEshop.com. That's how we first learned of the new name. It also says CFO on the front of the shirt, which is short for Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly. Not the band that has been doing most of the WWE music the last few years. That would be CFOs. Yes, all this time I've been saying CFO Money. Apparently I was wrong. The correct way to say their name is CFOs. That's straight from their own Twitter. You learn something new every day. This week's show is capped by a good main event, a great ending. The UK crew was all over the end of this show, as were Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly, which has me pretty excited for the eventual six-man tag that we better be getting. Anyway, Ruby Riott. Remember, she approached Regal last week and said, "I want Billy Kay and Peyton Royce in a handicap match." And Regal said, no, you've got to go find a tag team partner. Her mystery partner for this match here turned out to be, well, she technically had no partner, which blatantly defied what Regal had said to her the week prior. And for some reason, they allowed the match to happen anyway. They rang the bell, and there she is. She's out there having a handicap match, which kind of made no sense. But anyway, Nikki Cross, of all people, in the middle of this match, her sworn rival, randomly shows up, tags herself in. Then, after she lays out Billy and Peyton, she tags back out, and that allows Ruby to hit the flying senton on Billy for the win. Ruby looked very confused after the match. People were really digging the two of them as tag team partners here. So, I mean, with Sanity basically turning, you know, de facto babyface here in their feud against Cole and O'Reilly, it makes sense that I guess Nikki Cross would also be a babyface. One thing we learned this week is that the Street Profits are really over at Full Sail. They've basically taken the place that Enzo and Cass used to occupy as the resident sort of really popular team on that brand. Montez Ford looks like he's going to be the breakout star of that team when the time comes. The guy he's super charismatic. He's very athletic. And his Red Solo Cup gimmick, the Red Solo Cup that he would bring to the ring, it's already catching on, although he was carrying a black cup with him this week. Apparently, you know, funny story here, apparently a bunch of fans had their Red Solo Cups that they brought with them to the tapings. confiscated by security at Full Sail when they tried to come in with them. So when you watch it back, because I was wondering, why is everybody holding up their cell phone with a picture of a red Solo cup? It reminded me of that time on Raw when they showed Sting backstage and JBL's, that's not Sting, that's a picture of Sting. And I'm like, well, why is everybody holding up a picture on their phone of a red Solo cup? Apparently, it's because they tried to bring actual red Solo cups in, but they were turned away. And it does kind of make sense. I mean, remember, you're on a college campus. So who knows what might be in those Solo cups? I can understand them not wanting people to come in with them. Montez, by the way, also engaged to Bianca Belair. I've talked a lot about her recently with the Mae Young Classic stuff. They are, in fact, engaged. And both of them have a very bright future in that company. So they beat the Ely brothers. Montez hit a beautiful frog splash off the top for the win. They then ran into the crowd to celebrate their victory. And in the crowd was a gentleman holding up a Street Profit sign who looked like the happiest man in the world. He looked like he just walked through the gates of Disney World. He could not be happier to be there. I even said on Twitter, I hope I can one day love someone the way that this guy loves the Street Profits. And I heard from the guy. He saw my tweet. His name is Kyle. And he has volunteered, this is his words, he has volunteered to teach me how to love. That's a generous offer. I appreciate that. I will pass. I feel like this is something I need to learn on my own, but thank you. Main event was Wolfgang challenging Pete Dunne for the WWE United Kingdom title, a UK title match in the main event of NXT. I mean, you can imagine how happy I was to be seeing this, as I have been waiting for months for these guys to start showing up more regularly here on the weekly NXT show, and I hope this is the beginning of that trend. The way these crowds react to Pete Dunne, every time he comes out, you can't hide this guy. I mean, you got Wolfgang and Tyler Bate and Trent Seven, and that they're great, but Pete Dunne, what are you doing? Why is this guy not on TV more often? He could be a star for them right now. And I feel like for months he has been hidden from the world. The thing I love about Wolfgang, though, I want to show Wolfgang some love. You guys know I'm a big fan of his. The thing I love about Wolfgang is, and this is what impressed me the first time I saw him in the UK tournament back in January, is that the guy's a heavyweight who moves around like a cruiserweight. He's in there wrestling the bruiserweight. I sound like Dr. Seuss now. But no, I mean, he's out there, you know, Wolfgang is doing flip dives over the ropes and moonsaults off the top, which is very impressive. I mean, he's not 400 pounds, but he's a bigger guy. So he went for a swanton off the top. Dunne did this awesome reversal, this counter into an armbar on the way down. He kind of caught him in an armbar. And then Dunne later on hit the bitter end, and that was all she wrote for poor Wolfie. Dunne retains. But then out comes Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Bobby Fish. I can't even call them by that other name. I'm hoping they just shorten it to Undisputed or The Undisputed. They gave their word. Remember, they gave their word to William Regal that they would not attack anybody anymore outside in the parking lot. So instead, I guess they're just going to attack people in the ring, which is what they did here. They surrounded Pete Dunne. For a moment there, you didn't know what was going to happen. It reminded me of when the Nexus showed up. Remember when the Nexus first showed up and they surrounded the ring and John Cena was kind of caught in the middle? He didn't know what to do, and then finally, he's like, well, it is what it is. And he went to go attack them, and they all ganged up on him. Now, that was 8-on-1. This is just 3-on-1. You thought maybe... Now, I'm watching this, right? So I see Pete Dunne is in the ring. He's being circled by Adam Cole, Bobby Fish, and Kyle O'Reilly. And I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, you know, these four together would actually be really cool. Like, you add Pete Dunne. That way, when Red Dragon beats Sanity for the tag team titles, which you know they will, and when Adam Cole beats Drew McIntyre for the NXT title, which I'm pretty sure he will, they can have all four titles instead of just three. It even makes sense. But Pete Dunne attacked them, and so they beat him down, and Wolfgang came to the rescue, but they beat him down, and this was like, kind of like a miniature version of the old NWO attacks. To go back to the Nexus point, what also made me think of the Nexus here is if you remember that first night the Nexus came out on Raw, they attacked John Cena. John Cena was wrestling CM Punk, who was wearing a mask, This was back, I guess, after he had... Why was he wearing a mask? I'm trying to remember. Was his head shaved I'm trying to remember exactly why he was wearing the mask. I remember Big Show, like, ripping the mask off of him on SmackDown in, like, a ladder mattress. I don't remember. But anyway, the point is, he was wrestling Punk. Punk was a heel. And even Punk went after the Nexus guys, and they beat him down. So it was cool because it wasn't just, hey, we're out here to beat up a babyface. They'll beat you down no matter who you are. Babyface, heel, doesn't matter. And that's what happened here, right? They were beating on Pete Dunne. Wolfgang came over. They beat on Wolfgang. So the people want Pete Dunne, because Pete Dunne goes to bail. He's done with this. He's in the aisleway, but he stops. And he turns around, and he kind of teases going back to save Wolfgang. The people want him to run down and make the save. And so Dunne obliges. He runs back down to the ring to a giant pop to make the save, to save his UK title. he reaches into the ring. He grabs the championship. He saves his belt because that's the most important thing in the world to him. And then he proceeds to walk out and leave Wolfgang to get killed. Now that's a fucking heel right there. Pete Dunne is a dick. So Adam Cole gives Wolfgang a shining wizard. The three of them end up bailing through the crowd because Tyler Bate and Trent Seven run out to make the save. It will be Bate and Seven against Fish and O'Reilly this Wednesday on NXT. I'm hoping we get that six-man tag I mentioned at some point with Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly against Bate, Seven, and Wolfgang, since Pete Dunne teaming with them would make absolutely no sense. I love the end of this week's show. Thumbs up. I thought this was great stuff. Let's talk very quickly here about Lucha Underground. This was the 100th episode, a landmark episode here for Lucha Underground this week. They have officially reached the 100 episode threshold for syndication. I think it's like 88 episodes now. I think it used to be 100. You would hit 100 and then you could be syndicated. Now it's like 88. But still, that's a big deal. Makes me all the more sad that we probably are not getting a season 4. Every week that goes by without any kind of news, without any kind of announcement, that light grows dimmer. It ain't looking too good for the future of Lucha Underground right now. So we'll enjoy what we have left. I don't know how many episodes are left. I know Ultima Lucha, when we get there in a few weeks, apparently is going to be 4 straight weeks. So how many more weeks of TV are left here in this season? I'm not sure. It could be 6 weeks. It could be 8 weeks. It could be 5 weeks. I'm not really sure. They haven't really given a start date yet for Ultima Lucha. But we're coming to an end here in this the next month and a half, probably, or so. Ricky Mandel told Johnny Mundo that he has officially changed his name to Ricky Mundo. He showed Johnny his new license. Unfortunately, Johnny sat him on the bench and had Marty the Moth take his place in the Atomicos match against Prince Puma Phoenix. They call him Cage, and the Mexican moron, a.k.a. Sexy Star. I told you I was going to use that name for her. Marty was stalking Melissa Santos outside the ring when the match was over. I should probably actually mention who won this match. Johnny Mundo hit the end of the world on Puma to get the win. So after the match, Marty is stalking Melissa Santos at ringside, and Melissa's fighting back. She slaps him. She slaps him again. She slapped this dude probably 4 times before Phoenix finally super kicked the shit out of Marty and then hugged Melissa. This week coming up, it's going to be Phoenix and Melissa Santos in her very first match against Marty the Moth and Mariposa. Meanwhile, during the match, there were multiple stories unfolding here. During the match, Jeremiah Crane stole Cage's Nintendo Power Glove from ringside, and then in a later skit, he showed up in, I guess, Mil Muertes's lair, and he went to give the glove to Katrina because he still has the hots for her. And of course, Katrina wants the gauntlet to give to the police captain, who we found out a few weeks back is actually her mother. Are you confused? You are? Too bad. So Cage shows up, he tries to get the gauntlet back, but he and Mil Muertes and Jeremiah Crane, they all start brawling, and as this is going on, Dario Cueto shows up, and he steals the gauntlet himself. So there you go, that's where we are. See? It's very easy to follow along. Pentagon pinned Dragon Azteca with the package pile driver to win one of the ancient Aztec medallions. That earns him a spot in the Gift of the Gods match at Ultima Lucha. Pentagon went to go break his arm after the match, but Matanza interrupted, and he destroyed Dragon Azteca himself. Dragon Azteca being, of course, the protege of Rey Mysterio, who was out next for a match with Matanza, which Matanza won. Matanza beat Rey Mysterio with his Wrath of the Gods slam. Rey got his foot on the ropes, but Dario was out there. He shoved it off before the referee could see. After the match, Matanza wrapped a chair, Brian Pillman style, around Rey's neck, ran him into the post a couple of times, throat first. And then Matanza picked up Rey, and he carried him to the back. And that was actually how the show ended. And, you know, if this is the end for Lucha Underground, and it looks like the end of Rey Mysterio's run in Lucha Underground for sure, no matter what happens, even if Lucha Underground does come back, one of the cool things about it is the final run that Rey got here, because he, by and large, I mean, it looks like he was able to stay healthy for these last two seasons and had some pretty damn good matches. I loved the match he had last year with Prince Puma. I thought that was an excellent match. A lot of people had this guy written off because of his knees, all the ring time he missed, his last run in WWE. You know, he was on the injured list off TV more than he was in the ring. And here he proved that he can still go. You know, when he's healthy, he can still go, and he can go at a high level. And so I think, you know, no matter what happens going forward and where he may end up, apparently he was having negotiations to go to GFW, and those fell apart, so he's not going to go there. He may stay in Mexico. He may wrestle for the Crash, which I think is Conan's promotion. He and Conan are tight. Wherever he goes, whatever he does, he'll be in the WWE Hall of Fame one day. That goes without saying. But Rey, you know, Rey can still go. You give him a few big matches each year, and I think he can pump out some good stuff. All right, let's get to your questions here in the mailbag, because I have a whole bunch of them, and I want to make sure I dedicate enough time to them. If you would like to submit a question for the mailbag, you may do so, thesolomonster@gmail.com. That is the email address. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We will start here with Alex from Jacksonville, Florida. I was just listening to an episode of the Stone Cold podcast where he says that Kenny Omega could be the next big thing in the U.S. and could potentially be the guy in WWE if they were to bring him in. With that being said, if Kenny Omega were to come to WWE, do you think he could potentially be the top guy in the company? I think it's cool that Austin is such a big fan of Kenny Omega's work. And look, I think if Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks come into WWE as a package deal, and they've kind of said this before, where one goes, the other would go, and you know, even the Bucks have dropped little hints in the past that they're not opposed to going at some point to WWE when they reach a certain point in their career, getting a little older, they don't want to travel to Japan back and forth anymore. They may well end up in NXT. I think if you can get the three of them to come in all at the same time, sort of as a package deal, that could be a lot of fun. They'd sell a lot of t-shirts. I think they'd do pretty well. I don't doubt that they can make WWE a lot of money. Do I trust WWE to do the right thing, to do right by those guys? No, I don't. I don't trust them at all. Some people they do very well with. A lot of other people they don't. And I almost feel like the Bucks in particular are the ones that, you know, WWE has had interest in bringing them in the past. And it's almost the case, I think, where they're the ones that sort of got away. I don't even know why I feel this way, but I feel like they probably look at the Bucks as like a pain in the ass to them. Because, you know, just, I don't know, whether it's the Bullet Club stuff or the Too Sweet stuff and the merch and everything else. It's, I do worry that eventually when they end up there, what's going to happen to them? You know, how are they going to be used? How are they going to be portrayed? I'm a little leery about that. But the fact is that WWE, they've got a lot of talent right now. I mean, they are stockpiled with talent. Most of which doesn't even come from their own developmental system. They have deals with the UK guys. The UK guys, Pete Dunne and Wolfgang and all those guys, are incredibly talented. Mark Andrews and Tyler Bate. And we barely get to see them. That's how many bodies they've got and how many people they're trying to, you know, promote and push on TV. We barely even get to see those guys. And those maybe are some of the best guys they have. So they're stockpiled right now. And we finally got to see the UK guys on NXT this week. I think Kenny Omega could be a top guy on a brand like SmackDown or a brand like NXT. Absolutely. As far as being the guy, no. I don't see it. Vince already has his guy. It's called, you know, his name is Roman Reigns. And Kenny Omega is not going to come along and change Vince McMahon's mind. Vince McMahon is not going to take one look at Kenny Omega and say, wait a minute, pal, we should be building around this guy. Ain't going to happen. Vince has his guy. Vince McMahon has spent the last three, soon to be four, WrestleManias trying to prove that he's right and everybody else is wrong. And Roman Reigns is the guy to build around for years and years to come. Kenny Omega will never be the guy in WWE. Just like Nakamura won't be. Just like AJ Styles won't be. AJ's 40, so I kind of get it. You know, Omega... Kenny Omega's honestly, I think, around the same age as Roman Reigns. Like, early to mid-30s. So age really shouldn't be a factor. But, you know, that's just how it is. At least as long as Vince McMahon is the one in charge. He has his guy already. I think Kenny Omega's real value, honestly, is staying with New Japan for now and being the face of their U.S. expansion. It's almost like they've not that they've had their own brand split, but you've got Okada as the IWGP champion. He's, you know, the for all intents and purposes, he's sort of the face of that brand. But as they expand now into the U.S. and do more shows there, I think Omega will be the face of that. And I think he already is. He has the U.S. title, and I think that's sort of how they are portraying him. I think that's a great role for him to be in. At some point, he's going to come to WWE because it's just inevitable that he will. I don't think he should be in any sort of rush to come in. You know, keep your freedom and keep building New Japan. I think that's the best thing for him to be doing right now. And I'm curious what you guys think. You know, I know there's a lot of divided opinion about Kenny Omega. Some people love the guy. Some people absolutely cannot stand him. They hate the goofy stuff that he's done before. They can't take him seriously. You know, me, I think he's more than proven himself this year as a top five guy in any company in the world. But I know, you know, you bring up his name and you get all these different opinions. So, yeah, I'd be curious to get your feedback to that. Let's see here. Aki from Finland. I am a big fan of Kevin Owens. I'm enjoying the feud with Shane McMahon. I like that he headbutted Vince McMahon. It makes the feud seem important. You could argue now that it's the biggest story on SmackDown. Meanwhile, Jinder Mahal is doing haha jokes. Jinder Mahal is the WWE champion. He is, on paper at least, the biggest thing on SmackDown. So why wasn't it Jinder who headbutted Vince? I'm trying to think of if I had a big storyline idea that would make almost anybody relevant and interesting, and I have a champion who is not working as well as planned, I would surely use this storyline to build my champion. So that comes from Aki in Finland. You're right in that Jinder is the WWE champion, and the title now feels like the third most important thing on the show, behind the Kevin Owens-Shane McMahon feud, and I would argue even behind AJ Styles and the U.S. title. That's how far back I would rank now the WWE title. And it shouldn't be that way. In their mind, if I had to venture a guess here, I would assume their thinking is something to the effect of, well, we can get two stories here. I mean, why put all of our eggs in one basket? We can have this one story of having the McMahons feuding with this guy, but the belt is a great way. It's like a prop, right? So we'll give this prop to this other guy who needs it and let him go do his thing. But, you know, obviously what ends up happening here is Jinder Mahal comes off like Alberto Del Rio did when he was the World Heavyweight Champion. He doesn't come across at all as the face of that brand or the biggest star on that brand. And yeah, in theory, it should be like it is with Brock on Raw. I mean, look at Raw and look at SmackDown. Brock Lesnar is the unbeatable, you know, universal champion. He is the number one, you know, star on Raw. He's the champion. That's the way it should be. On SmackDown, it's not like that at all. Again, Jinder Mahal does not come across as the end-all be-all at all on SmackDown, nor has, you know, he somehow been elevated by having the championship. If anything, he's brought that thing down. Or the way he's been slotted on the show, it's brought that thing down. Some people are going to disagree with me on ranking the U.S. belt above that, you know, right now. And you know, but again, we've seen the U.S. title headline SmackDown plenty of times. AJ is, I mean, way more over than Jinder is. He's got this open challenge now. You know, I rank that above what they're doing with the WWE title. And I agree with you in that it shouldn't be that way. Santos from Lancaster. I assume that means Pennsylvania, but I could be completely wrong. It could be a completely different country for all I know. Wrestling fans have been conditioned to expect a male superstar to be the guy, as WWE is trying to do with Roman Reigns. But with the women being a bigger deal now, like Sasha Banks, Charlotte, and possibly others like Asuka or Kairi Sane, do you think WWE should get behind a female star as the top star in the company instead? So basically what he's saying is picking a female star to be the guy, so to speak. I'm on record, and you guys know this, that I'm on record as saying that I think the concept of the guy, quote-unquote, is stupid and outdated. I never understood why you would want to rely on just one guy as the face of your company. Why not promote two or three or four people at that same level? Especially if the guy goes down to an injury, you've got to have at least a couple of guys that are on the same level who you can slot in there if this guy goes down to an injury, if he gets suspended, which, by the way, Roman was last year. Stuff happens. So I never understood that. I just never got that. Why you wouldn't promote somebody as heavily as you do, you know, a John Cena when he was on top, or a Roman Reigns now when he's on top. If you're going to do it for the men, then absolutely, they should have two or three women, I think, that fit the same bill. With all the new talent they have coming out of the Mae Young Classic, the timing has never been better. Charlotte, Sasha Banks, Toni Storm. I know Toni Storm is not signed. I thought she was, but she's not. But if they can sign her eventually, my God, I mean, that woman is a superstar in the making. Are you kidding me? You know, some people laugh at Charlotte and Bayley, when they go out and they do interviews, and Sasha's done this too, they go out and they talk about the women headlining WrestleMania one day, and people scoff. You know what? With the right women, I believe they can do that. I don't think it's far-fetched at all. First of all, you just know the WWE would love all the publicity that they would get for promoting the first WrestleMania ever with an all-female main event, okay? Never underestimate their love for positive press or their ability to talk about how progressive they are. Never underestimate that. That's first of all. Second of all, if it happens, I think Charlotte is a lock to be part of it. And it could very well be against Asuka. Maybe not next year, because Asuka's going to Raw and Charlotte's on SmackDown. But the first Charlotte versus Asuka match, especially if Asuka gets over on the main roster anywhere near the way she did in NXT, or if they keep her undefeated and they kind of build her own streak up for a WrestleMania match, I think that match, you can headline a WrestleMania with that match. Maybe in 2019. Let me ask you this. Would people really be that upset if WWE took a chance and headlined a WrestleMania with two women instead of Roman fucking Reigns? Because you know he's going to be in the next 5 years of WrestleMania main events. He's already been in the last three. You do know that. Would people really protest that? Would they really be that upset? Would they not watch WrestleMania this year because of that? Give me a break. At the very least, and I think you can do, I think, as early as next year in New Orleans. At the very least, they should promote a double main event for WrestleMania. One with the men, one with the women. Even if the women don't necessarily go on last. And with Ronda Rousey and all this talk about the horsewomen, that could very well be billed as one half of a double main event next year. So why not start conditioning people now for the inevitable? Because it's coming. It may take a few years, but I believe it will happen. Amay from Mumbai, India. With Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar likely to face off at WrestleMania 34, I think either John Cena or Bill Goldberg would be a great potential WrestleMania opponent for Braun Strowman. Who is your pick? I do think Cena is the best option. Now, they gave it away on TV this week, but Strowman dominated like 90% of the match. They could come back with it and do the rematch at WrestleMania. You know, short of wrestling for the championship, really, it would be the biggest possible match for Braun Strowman. I've seen enough of him and Roman Reigns. They have great matches. They have great chemistry together. But we've seen Strowman and Roman so many times. I don't look at that as a WrestleMania match. And again, Roman, he's going to be busy. Goldberg would be all wrong. First of all, Goldberg isn't coming back to do the job, I don't think, at two straight WrestleManias. That's not happening. And honestly, I don't really see what's to be gained by basically repeating with Strowman what they already did with Brock Lesnar. I think it should be John Cena or Samoa Joe. I think Cena or Joe are the two guys that make the most sense as a potential WrestleMania opponent next year for Braun Strowman. Right? A singles match, maybe a street fight with Strowman and Joe. I think that could be a lot of fun. B. Lump from Salone, Ohio. If the Royal Rumble was held next month with the current roster as it is now, who would you pick to win? AJ Styles. AJ Styles would win the Royal Rumble. Nakamura beats Jinder at Hell in a Cell, so we get that championship away from Jinder. Nakamura holds the title all the way to WrestleMania. AJ wins the Rumble. You do Styles and Nakamura at WrestleMania with AJ winning the belt back. Dean from Scotland. I've been a big Bray Wyatt fan since his NXT days and still feel he can be a main event talent, but it's fair to say he's been treading water for a while now. What is stopping WWE from pulling the trigger on Bray as a face? They clearly toyed with the idea when he teamed with Roman before getting injured. Yeah, that was a test. That felt like a test to me too, and a test that he passed. People were way into him when they did that. There's nothing stopping them. There's absolutely nothing stopping them. If they're worried about too many baby faces and not enough heels, you know what? Do a double turn with Bray and Roman. You know, not necessarily in a match together, but you flip Bray, you flip Roman around the same time. You flip Roman heel, you make Bray more of a face or a tweener type. Then you've got Wyatt, you've got Balor, you've got Rollins, you've got Ambrose. Cena, he may not be around much, but you've got Cena as a baby face. I think Samoa Joe could easily come back as more of a tweener and not a heel so much when he comes back. So there you go. You got tons of baby faces. They could pull it off if they wanted to. Here's the thing, though. Bray's got to change things up a bit if he's going to be a baby face. I don't care what he is. His shtick is tired. Heel, baby face. If he's just going to continue to do the same stuff and cut the same promos, it's going to get old real fast. If he can change it up a bit, I think he could be very successful as this sort of cult-like babyface. Andre from Brazil. Speedball Mike Bailey is apparently banned from working in the U.S. until the year 2021 because he worked in the country before without his papers. Do you know anything about this? Has anybody been caught in the same situation before? I don't know of anybody who's been caught working without a, you know, a working visa here in this country, for at least not for any major promotion. I do know for a fact there have been guys over the years that have wrestled here without a valid work visa, and they've gotten away with it. Or they've worked, you know, without it having come through, like maybe it was still stuck in process or something. Unfortunately for Speedball over here, he got caught. And so what that means is that he is banned from working in the U.S. for up to 5 years. And it's a shame. You know, I haven't seen a lot of his PWG stuff, but I did see just a few weeks ago, somebody on Facebook sent me a link to a match that he had as part of this WCPW, like the What Culture, the big tournament that they had. And there was a match in the tournament between Speedball Mike Bailey and Will Ospreay. And I watched the match, and I thought it was awesome. It was great. You know, the guy's really talented. But for now, he's stuck working all over the world, everywhere except the U.S. You know, 5 years, though. 5 years is a lifetime. I don't know if that can somehow get resolved. Maybe he can come back in two or three. But in wrestling, you know, five years is a lifetime. A lot can change in 5 years. And it's a really, it's a shitty situation for him. We have Leonidas from California. How would you feel if WWE moved to a performance-based victory system, whether it be judges on the side of the ring scoring suplexes and slams higher than strikes, for example, or some other system where the winner is the one who has the more convincing performance in the ring? After watching Jason Jordan's matches with Roman Reigns and John Cena, it infuriates me to see wrestlers like Jordan who bust their butts performing a variety of suplexes, slams, and other innovative offense, all so that he loses to a weak-looking maneuver. I feel like basing the winner off the amount of offense he performs makes the match feel more legit. What do you think? I get what you're saying. It just, it doesn't work. That's not what pro wrestling is. Now, we've had, even TNA has tried this, like judges and stuff, although they're not judging based off who had the most, innovative suplexes and stuff. I don't know. I think it just goes against what pro wrestling should be. I think it would be boring, honestly. If you're going to judge matches based on who had the best-looking moves, then the cruiserweights would be in the main event every week. I mean, let's be honest here. It doesn't work. But I also think judging matches that way is boring, right? I'm all for incorporating elements of sport into pro wrestling and making things more realistic. I'm totally down for that. I think there's absolutely room to do more of that. But at the end of the day, wrestling is not pure sport, right? There's a reason that wrestling is not MMA. There's a reason that it's not boxing. It doesn't go to the judges. You can't change what wrestling is. You can make it more entertaining. You can make it more fun. You can make it more realistic. I think wrestling will always evolve. When it gets boring is when you have promoters and bookers and writers who are unable to evolve with the times and just give us the same old shit. That's a big problem in wrestling right now. But I mean, let's be honest. If they ever did a system like the one you just described, I mean, they would give John Cena or Roman Reigns, who I know that's who you're referring to, as having the weak-looking moves, right? They would just give Cena or Reigns more offense so they score more points. It's like, that's all that would happen. They would have more offense on their opponent, or John Cena would bust out a code red like he does every now and then, right? And he'd get all the points. Like, I don't really understand what you're going for here. I mean, it's not like the outcomes of the matches would be any different. So I don't really see what the point of that would be. Hogan used to win with a leg drop. Rock used to win matches with a friggin' standing elbow. Cena uses a fireman's carry slam. Those three guys I just named also made that company a shitload of money over the years. I think they did pretty well for themselves. So it's not always about all the flashy moves. You know, it's about how, you know, you portray these guys. So again, I don't know that a system like that would really work. Let's see here. JR from Denton, Texas. Are there any updates on the promotion that Brittany Page, Brooke Hogan, Lacey Von Erich, and Ariel Toombs were in talks of launching since last year? Last I read, they claimed to have a 40-woman roster and were looking to start touring in September. Who have they signed and where are they touring? That's a great question. Just to give some background on this, because I'm sure a lot of people have no idea what you're talking about. I had forgotten until I got your question. I knew about this, but I had completely forgotten about it. So last year, it was actually about a year ago, TMZ caught up with DDP's daughter, Brittany. She was at the airport, and they were interviewing her, and she broke the news that she and some other daughters of famous wrestlers were planning to start their own women's wrestling league, their own women's wrestling promotion. Her and Brooke Hogan and Lacey Von Erich and Roddy Piper's daughter, Ariel. I think even Jean-Claude Van Damme's daughter would be involved in this in some way. And she was all excited about it. And she even said Christy Hemme was going to be involved in some way. And that it was going to be competition for TNA wrestling, whatever that means. That's what she said. Somehow, I don't think Christy Hemme is going to be doing much for them. Not now, anyway. But like I said, that was like a year ago. And then there was nothing until Brooke Hogan brought it up again a few months ago. Brooke was at the premiere for GLOW. Brooke had a cameo on one of the episodes of GLOW, for those of you Eagle Eye folks who remember. She was on one of the episodes. And Brooke claimed at the time, and this only would have been in like June or July, so not that long ago, she claimed that they were moving full speed ahead. She claimed that they had a roster. The roster was over 40 women deep. They were going to start touring in September. Well, guess what? We're more than halfway through September, and we haven't even gotten any announcements. let alone is there a touring schedule. There's nothing. So what I did, I said, why not just go straight to the source? Instead of just speculating, I went and I sent a tweet to DDP's daughter asking about it. I figured just go right to the source, but she has not gotten back to me yet. So if she does, I will report back on what she says. If there's anybody listening who's connected to her or knows anything about this this league or this promotion, and they want to kind of get out in front of this instead of people wondering and figuring that it's a dead deal, you know, reach out to me and let me know. I'd love to know if there's any information out there. I am skeptical about them having a roster with over 40 women. Or at least I'm wondering who these women are, especially since WWE just did their own tournament with 32 women, a lot of whom have either been signed already or probably are going to end up being signed. I'm wondering how many of these 40 names, you know, are people that we would even recognize. We don't know. So I'm still waiting to hear back, but like I said, it's been a year now and nothing, and that's probably not a great sign. Christian from Las Vegas. I was watching some early 2011 segments on YouTube and was reminded of the mini feud between The Miz and Jerry Lawler. I think it was an underrated feud that gave Miz some much-needed heat and also toyed with the idea that Lawler could possibly win the WWE title at the end of his career. It really reminded me of the Sting-Seth Rollins feud in 2015 with the young, brash heel taking on the old legend in his only shot for the title. Had Sting not been injured, I always heard he was rumored to wrestle 2 weeks later at the Madison Square Garden show, possibly against Rollins. I think either man could have won it and dropped it back to the young heel in the rematch, Sting at MSG or Lawler at Elimination Chamber, in a quick thank you title run. Buy or sell, on which of the two you would have rather seen, Jerry Lawler winning the WWE title in 2011 or Sting winning the title in 2015? I said this at the time, and I will say it again now. Lawler should have beaten Miz for the championship on that Elimination Chamber show. I am buying on a Jerry Lawler title win, and I am going to sell on Sting. Not that I don't think Sting winning the title, let's say at Madison Square Garden, would not have been a cool moment, or even winning it at the pay-per-view and then dropping it back to Rollins at Madison Square Garden, okay? Sting winning the title would have been a very cool moment. And Sting showed us, until he got hurt, that he could still go. He wasn't in there looking, too old. He looked like he could certainly, hold the title for a month or something, and I don't think people really would have minded that much. But the Lawler story was so perfect. He had, if you remember, he had what I thought was a shockingly good TLC match on Raw with The Miz a couple of months before. He came so close to winning the championship in that match, and the people were into it, right? Until I think, was it Alex Riley maybe came in the ring and knocked him off the ladder or something? They told the story, though, that Lawler had never had a match at WrestleMania before. That was a big story going into Mania that year because he was going to have a match with Michael Cole. But the story was that he had never had a WrestleMania match before, and he badly wanted one, and this was his chance. So a month before Mania, you can have Lawler win the championship, and the idea is that he's the champ. He's going to walk into WrestleMania as the champion, which means he gets his first WrestleMania match, and he's going in as the champ. Now, there's not a chance in hell I would have sent Jerry Lawler all the way to WrestleMania as the champion to wrestle in the main event. But why not let him win it on that Chamber show and then drop it back to Miz on TV the next night in the rematch? Like, for those 24 hours, let people think that Jerry Lawler is going to realize his dream and he's going to get his WrestleMania match, a WrestleMania main event no less, only for Miz to just crush his dreams and steal the championship back. That would make Miz even more hated than he was. I think that would have been a really cool moment, and plus it would have been a feel-good moment. There were so many different reasons that they could have done it. It wouldn't have hurt Miz. It wouldn't have hurt them at all. It would have created this moment that people would remember, and I'm sure for Lawler it would have been a great moment, but like business-wise, it wouldn't have made a difference either way. You know? And fans would have bought into it, too. Not everybody, but Lawler had a lot of crowd support during that storyline. It's not like he was out there embarrassing himself, and people were booing him, and they were sitting on their hands. You know, if there's one thing Lawler knows how to do, probably to this day, is work a crowd. He was a master at that. He never did a lot. Lawler was not a flashy wrestler. And in fact, his one big move was banned by WWE, so he couldn't even do that. But Lawler had a lot of support during that storyline. Plus, he had the story of his mom. His mom had just passed away. Now, the way they worked that into the storyline with Cole, I thought was completely tasteless. Obviously, he was okay with it. I'm sure on some level he probably, you know, probably wasn't, but he agreed to it and went along with it. So if he's okay with it, then whatever. But I still thought it was in bad taste what they did, the way that Cole, you know, brought up his mom's death and all that. But you could have worked that into the storyline in a more kind of respectful way that played into the story where, you know, his mom had just passed away and they were very close, and he could even dedicate that match going into Elimination Chamber to his mom. I would have had him win, and even better, I would have let him win that match with a pile driver. Go to Vince, have him make a one-time exception. I know the answer probably would have been, you know, fuck off, but I would have at least tried. There's no harm in asking. There's no safer person to deliver the pile driver than Jerry Lawler. Lawler's been winning with that move for like 40 years, okay? He probably came out of the womb giving a pile driver to somebody. For a 24-hour token title reign, there was no harm in doing it. And by the way, I remember reading at the time, they did consider it. This was not an idea that was off limits and laughed off. They considered it. Vince thought about putting the championship on Jerry Lawler. It could have happened. And then in the end, he decided against it. It's too bad. Darius from Baton Rouge. Buy or sell on the better performer, and above all else, the better monster. Matanza Cueto or Braun Strowman? I've seen a lot more Braun Strowman than I have Jeff Cobb this year, but Cobb is an amazing performer. If you've never seen a Jeff Cobb match, you owe it to yourself to either go to an indie show that he's on or find something on YouTube or something. He's the one who portrays Matanza on Lucha Underground. He's incredible. He's incredible. If anything, the Matanza character and the Matanza mask and the whole getup and everything actually holds him back from what he's able to do. But he's great. It's hard to say. I mean, define performer, right? That means something different to everybody. If you know, you have to define that word for me first. So that would be a start. Better monster? Dude, Matanza has literally killed people. He ate another man's face off. There is no comparison. As a monster, you buy on Matanza. I mean, come on. It's crazy. William from Calgary, buy or sell? We'll end with this. Buy or sell on the unreleased WWE match that you would like to see the most. Bret Hart versus Tom McGee from 1986, or Kurt Angle versus Owen Hart in 1999. I'm going to buy on Kurt against Owen, because I think that would be a trip to see those two wrestle. I think the match they had was only a few weeks before Owen died, because I'm pretty sure that match was in May of 99. It was a dark match in May of 99, and Owen died, it was like May 23rd, I think it was. With Owen, that whole period is still pretty vivid for me. I think the pay-per-view was the 23rd, and then I think they did the tribute to him on Raw on the 24th. So the match with Kurt, I think, would have only been a few weeks before that. Unfortunately, it's not on the new unreleased matches DVD that they just put out. That DVD is specifically for matches from 1986 to 1995, which means they could have put the Bret Hart-Tom McGee match on there, and those bastards didn't do it. Because it's probably under lock and key, never to be seen for some reason. It has to, I would imagine. Maybe they don't have video of it. I mean, I think, I'm pretty sure Bret Hart has claimed that there is video of it. He's seen it. He might even have it. You know, they taped all that stuff back then. So I'm sure they have a tape of it somewhere. Why they won't release it, I have no idea. So the Owen-Kurt match wouldn't have been on this one, since it kind of ends at 1995. But if that DVD does well enough, and I hope it does, and they do a volume 2. You know, I know the whole situation with Martha. And I don't think that's really stopped them from putting Owen Hart matches on DVDs. So I would hope that if there's a volume 2 of the unreleased match series, that Kurt Angle Owen Hart match ends up on there. So I guess we'll find out. But I'm going to buy on that one. And we'll end with that. If you have questions, keep emailing me. thesolemonster@gmail.com. Don't forget, there is a brand new Ric Flair book being released this Tuesday, September 19th, and the audiobook version is available on audible.com. You can get it for free, but only if you use our link to sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up. Even if you cancel the trial so you don't get billed before the 30 days are up, if you cash in on this new Ric Flair book, you get to keep it. You don't get billed for it. Comes out this Tuesday. It's called The Legacy of Ric Flair and the Rise of Charlotte, written by Brian Shields. Take advantage of it. You can pre-order it right now, or you can wait until Tuesday and sign up and then buy the book then. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle on there. Thank you to the 24,000-plus following along with my inane ramblings on there. There is a pay-per-view next Sunday, which means we'll have No Mercy predictions on the show next weekend, so I know we'll be doing that. I'm sure there'll be a ton of other news that comes up in the course of the next 7 days. There always is. There's never any rest for the weary here on this show. So that'll be episode 514 on our march, I guess. We're on the march to our 10-year anniversary show in November. It's not that far off. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. For those of you celebrating the Jewish New Year, Happy New Year. And I will see you back here next weekend for another podcast. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. See, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.